Welcome to episode 157 of Speaking of Mysteries. My name is Nancy Clare, and my guest for the podcast is Val McDermott, whose Broken Ground, her fifth novel featuring Karen Pyrie, has just been published in North America. Val is an award-winning writer of more than 30 crime fiction novels, as well as nonfiction, short stories, and, upcoming, plays. And as the saying goes, that's not all. Val was a judge for the 2018 Man Booker Prize. She programs crime fiction festivals, and she's now a visiting professor of Scottish Studies and Crime Fiction at New Zealand's Otago University. Oh, and she's the singer in the rock band Fun Lovin' Crime Writers. Here's Val McDermott. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. My guest today is Val McDermott, or should I address you as Professor McDermott?
Only when I'm actually in New Zealand, I think.
The last time we spoke was 2014, right after The Skeleton Road was published. And the book was described by your U.S. publisher as a standalone, but it was the third novel featuring Karen Pyrie. And I asked you if you were on the cusp of another series. You demurred. And here's Karen back. So is she a series?
I guess I have to say yes now that there's five books featuring her. It was never my intention to start another series, but she just caught up with me, and I keep hearing her voice and coming up with great story ideas for her, so it's very hard to turn away from someone who provides you with such good material.
And I guess we should mention that the new novel's entitled Broken Ground, and she does have an extraordinary voice in it, so I'm glad you're listening.
She's hard to escape.
She really sticks with you, and I'm going to ask a couple of questions about her in particular, and maybe we can talk about that, or you can talk about it, and I can listen. One of the cold cases that she's investigating in Broken Ground, it features a body that's been in the ground an indeterminate amount of time when it's discovered. And which is great, because now Karen is going to get to work with Dr. River Wild, who I think has one of the best names of a character ever. I know writers are like parents and you're not supposed to have favorites, but I think you really like River.
I do. She also started out in a standalone novel. Her first appearance was in The Grave Tattoo, which doesn't feature Karen at all. But it's very definitely a standalone. But I created her for that book. And then a couple of books into Karen Pyrie, I realized I needed a good forensic anthropologist. And I remembered that I already had one, so I didn't have to go to the trouble of inventing a new one. So I kind of imported her from the standalone into the series. I think sometimes you create a character and if it's a standalone, you almost regret having to say goodbye to them, because you understand that that character has so much more to offer you.
You know, I ask this question a lot with writers who've done both series and standalones. And I talked to Olin Steinhauer, who does a series with Milo, Milo the Spy, I call him. I forget his last name. It must be difficult, because as you said, you create these characters, you listen to their voices, and then you put them aside. You have a few standalones. One that comes to mind for me is The Vanishing Point. You had such great characters in that book, and they've stayed in that book.
Yeah, but sometimes with the standalones, of course, the problem sometimes is that they don't lend themselves to going any further for whatever reason. For example, it may be that your sleuth is a non-traditional detective. And I think these days it's very hard to justify more than one or two books with a character who's an amateur sleuth, effectively. So that's one of the reasons why you sometimes have to just let them go. But it is hard. And, you know, with the Place of Execution, for example, some years ago now, I created a great detective in George Bennett, but the book is quite categorically described as his finest case, his finest hour. And you can't really then go back to, oh, here's George's second finest hour from that point, you know.
You kind of damn it with faint praise from the get-go.
Yeah, yeah.
And your nicknames that you give your characters, which I know, I mean, I can imagine that in a police station, a nick, as they're called in the UK, that happens. It certainly happens in, I worked at a newspaper and boy, we had some doozies. You've got Jason the Mint Murray, who is Karen's very lovable. I really like him. Second in command. And then you've got Anne Markle, and we'll talk a little bit about Anne in a second, but her nickname is Dog Biscuit. So,
yeah,
you know, how do you, what happens inside your brain to come up with these? Because they are amazing.
Well, she's called the Dog Biscuit because her surname is Markie, and in the UK there's a kind of dog treat called Markies. It looks a bit like a sausage roll. For dogs, and so, you know, obviously it's the Markie, the Dog Biscuit. And I think, if, like you, I worked in newspapers, and in newspapers, like in police units, people have these imaginative nicknames for each other that by the time you've actually explained them to an outsider and watched their eyes glaze over, you understand that ours is a very particular world with very particular relationships. And I think that, you know, that particularly with cops, people are very reliant. Officers are very reliant on their colleagues. They work as a team or they work as a pair. And you do depend on your colleagues. So those little ways of building bonds, I think, can be very useful.
One thing I enjoyed about this book was, you know, Karen suffered a great loss in the Skeleton Road. She lost her partner. And she's evolving as a human being, and she's, you know, moving past it in her own very Karen-esque way. But she walks through the city, and I think you did a wonderful job of taking Edinburgh, which is still this wonderful Victorian city, and shown how it's changing. And I enjoyed that with Cafe Aleppo and some of the men that she had met in the previous book, you know, setting up something to do. I thought that was a wonderful way to bring the present into a story.
Well, thank you. I very much feel I want to write about modern Scotland as it is, and more Edinburgh as it is. You know, people have images in their head of what Edinburgh is like, and it's the castle, and it's the Royal Mile, and it's the new town, and it's all the grandeur of the city. But the city is so much more than that. You know, it has a commercial side, it has a university side, it's got a lot of different aspects to it, and it's got its as well. It's got its poor as well as its wealthy. And I wanted to write about the way that modern Scotland is in the context of the books. It's slightly difficult in some ways because each individual book is set in the time that I'm writing it, quite specifically in terms of time and place. But, of course, Karen doesn't age in the same way. Because I thought when Karen first appeared, it wasn't meant to be a series. So the first book was actually published in 2003, The Distant Echo. So the book spanned 15 years, but I think Karen's only actually aged about 3 years. It's a bit like dog years, you know? Okay. I think from henceforward, I want to live my life in Karen Piri years, you know?
Well, it is, you know, that is one thing about fiction. You can create your own space-time continuum and have it on different tracks. So it does not defy the laws of physics of fiction.
Yeah.
But, you know, you talk about time and place. In this book, other books like The Skeleton Road, you went into the Balkans. And this one, your time and place, you went to World War II. And I liked the reminder that Scotland had a very crucial role in the war. And the case does link to World War II. So I was wondering what might have triggered using that particular construct for the mystery?
It was a couple of things. One of it was that pure serendipity that comes with putting a book together was that I was reading actually a biography of Josephine Tay, and in the course of this, the writer just mentioned in passing something that I'd known but forgotten that I knew, which is that the island north of the Great Glen in the Second World War was a restricted area. And as it goes with these things, I sort of thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. I wonder if there's anything I can use there. I wonder if there's something that's possible for me. And the other thing was, of course, that much of the stuff that went on in the Highlands during the was covered by the 70-year rule. So a lot of it we've only actually learned about in the last few years, the extent of, for example, the work of the Special Operations Executive, the people who were trained there to go behind enemy lines and spy on the Germans. And so a lot of that we just didn't know because the papers were sealed. But in the last 3 or 4 years, much of that has become available. It's become public, and so again, that was a sense of there's possibilities opening up here that I didn't really understand fully before.
You know, for our listeners that are geographically challenged, Scotland is very, very close to Norway, and of course, Norway was an occupied country in World War II, occupied by the Nazis, yeah. And so it made it a rough crossing, but a short one. To get people into Norway.
Yeah, but also the agents that were going into France were trained in the Highlands because basically because the countryside was so empty, and it was also quite useful for training people in rough terrain. So the commandos, for example, trained in the Highlands, and the submarine base was at Longyearbyen, and that was where the Russian convoys sailed from as well. So there was a lot of military activity of different sorts going on in the Highlands during that time. And so there was a lot of crossover and a lot of possibilities for people to do things that weren't necessarily being closely scrutinized at the time because there was so much other stuff going on.
You know, there are trends in crime fiction, and this next question comes from an interview I read in preparation for talking to you this morning. You said you felt the tide was turning away from sort of domestic suspense, as in, you know, a secret from her past, and it's usually her past, comes back to bite her type of stories, to historical fiction. And so what that set off in me was I started to think of Arthur Miller's The Crucible, which, of course, is a play about the Salem witch hunt, which Miller wrote during the McCarthy era in the States when we had people in the Senate that were chasing communists, and I have air quotes. Do you think writers who I think are cultural early warning bellwethers are seeking out parallels from the past to sound the alarm on the present?
I think that's one of the things that is happening, that people are using the past as a prism to write about the present, to explore the present in a way that, for whatever reason, they can't necessarily do openly, sometimes for legal reasons, for obvious legal reasons, but also sometimes simply because it somehow seems clearer, the way through seems to be possible to take a clearer line through events when you're looking at something that's historical rather than something that's clouded by the complicated ways that people behave in the present. So I think that I think crime fiction has increasingly become the novel of social history, but sometimes it does seem easier to make those parallels, to make those discussions, to have those discussions if you're in the past, or sometimes even the quite recent past. You know, you read something like Lou Berne's November Road,
which amazing.
Is set against the back. Set against the backdrop of the Kennedy assassination, but a book that also says things to us about our time now.
How sometimes we only think things have changed, especially for women. I mean, I found his character of the woman running from her life to something. I found it a book of about people not just running away, but running to things.
Yeah, and I think that's something that as I say, we have the opportunity at this particular point in the crime novel's history to approach all sorts of things from all sorts of angles. And I find that very exciting. You know, when I was starting out, the crime novel was a much more straightforward thing, a much more simple thing. It didn't have the kind of range and has now. And I feel very lucky that I started writing crime fiction at a time when so many things about the genre were changing, and so many writers were coming along who were changing the way we looked at crime fiction and the way we thought about crime fiction. You know, writers like Sarah Paretsky were turning things on their head, making it possible for many of us to write a very different kind of book from the one we maybe would have written 10 years before.
Well, I think you have to add yourself into that category, since you were a pioneer in actually having a lesbian protagonist who, in your own description, was very flash, and she drove a sports car. And I think there's, you know, that those trends in crime fiction, I think, are very important, and I think the diversity and inclusion that's going on in crime fiction is very important, and hopefully, you know, part of the vanguard for the rest of the world. I'm by nature a pessimist, so I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think we keep seeing new writers emerging, you know, over the years who revolutionise what the genre can do. I mean, you're thinking about writers like Attica Locke, for example, whose books I think are extraordinary. And really, for me, you know, looking at America from the outside, I find them really revelatory novels, and I think that she's opened a lot of windows on worlds that none of us knew anything about before.
Absolutely.
For example.
But back to Karen. You know, what I like about Karen is she doesn't go along to get along. She was at loggerheads with her former boss, who went down in flames, partially because of Karen. And her new boss, Ann Markey, is a woman, and she's smart, and that about ends their common ground. This is like sort of like, from the outside, women are all supposed to get along and lean in, and you know, I thought that was just an extraordinarily interesting dynamic that they don't really get along.
Yeah, I mean, Karen has female friends and colleagues that she gets along with very well, but also, I mean, I wanted to, you know, I didn't want it to be all just one big cozy happy family. I've worked with women bosses who were absolutely not in the business of holding out a helping hand to the women underneath them, and you know, it's not the case that, you know, we may all be sisters under the skin, but sometimes the skin on the surface is not very sisterly at all. and so, I mean, I try very hard in my work to paint a sort of cross section of how people are, to down the sort of simple, easy, straightforward tropes, but actually to dig a little bit deeper and think about how these relationships develop and you know, why they are the way they are and how are they going to develop as we go along. You know, I don't know what's going to happen with Karen and Ann Markey in the next book, but somehow don't think it's going to be a straight road.
You have an astounding work ethic. You publish at least one book a year, often more. You're now a visiting professor of Scottish Studies and Crime Fiction at Otago University. And did I pronounce that right?
I think it's Otago, but let's not quarrel about it.
Okay, Otago University in New Zealand. And you program crime fiction festivals. So I'm wondering if you sleep.
Sometimes better than others. I'm bad tempered if I'm not busy. You know, I'm not particularly nice to be around if I've not got lots of things on the go. Well, and also, I find that the more you do, the more fertile your ideas become.
That should be inspiration for. Matter of fact, you should make that into a T-shirt that you can wear and market on your site, because, of course, you are famous for your T-shirts.
Yes. Entirely by accident. There was no design in that at all, but it seems to have turned out that way. But I think, you see, I'm one of the things that I find very exciting in the last, probably about the last 3 or 4 years, is that I seem to have come to a point in my career where people are now coming to me with interesting projects, some of them collaborative projects, some of them asking me to think a little bit outside the box for myself. And that, for me, is really exciting because I relish the challenge. You know, I've always had a restless imagination. I'm not somebody who wants to stand still. And so I've been doing other things. So, for example, I did a theatre stage play this year, and I learned so much from the process of working on that. And as a result of that, I've been commissioned to do a main house play for one of the big theatres in Edinburgh, which will probably be done as a collaboration with the London West End Theatre. So that's something else that I'll be working on. I've got my band, the Fun Loving Crime Rioters, which allows me to go out of the house and sing, which is just glorious. There's lots of other smaller projects that I've been doing on the side, which excite me and you know, make me get up in the morning.
You actually anticipated one of my questions about your musical career. But before that, you didn't mention that you were judged for this year's Man Booker Prize, which I think, I remember in 2012, I went to the first Bloody Scotland Crime Writing Festival, and there was a discussion about crime fiction vis-a-vis the Man Booker. And so I thought, even in 6 years, you told the New York Times that because you wrote genre fiction, you weren't someone who instantly springs to mind as a judge of literary fiction, which of course I think is, you know, not true. But does that chasm between literary fiction and genre fiction really still exist? I would think you would be a fantastic judge for all the reasons you've just described, that you have a mind that wants to take all of this in.
I think it's not a chasm anymore. I think it's more of a ditch now. I think the distance between the perceived distance, shall we say, between genre and so-called literary fiction has diminished considerably in recent years. And I think that's because, you know, the top end, if you like, the best of crime fiction, I think, can stand shoulder to shoulder with anything. You know, we have extraordinary writers like Laura Lippman, like Kate Atkinson, and writers whose prose, if you like, stands comparison with anybody else's. And I think that's something that people are gradually coming to realise. I think the old literary snobbery between crime fiction and other forms of fiction was often fuelled by ignorance. You know, people were commenting about crime fiction who hadn't actually picked up a crime novel since Agatha Christie or Raymond Chandler, and were making judgments that were based, as I say, not necessarily on a experience of what people were producing. So I think it is changing slowly but surely, and you know, the gauntlet, I suppose, is to throw down to all of us to write the best books we can write.
And then, of course, there is your musical career.
The band is actually, it's me and Mark Billingham, Chris Brookmeyer, Doug Johnson, Stuart Neville and Luca Vesti. There's the six of us, and we rock.
You do rock. How do you rehearse?
We do.
Luca, I know, lives in Ireland, and you know, you don't all live in the same neighborhood. You can't all hang out
in
your garage.
No, unfortunately not. Although my neighbours might have something to say if we did.
I think the music's good enough that they would probably be fine with it. When is your next performance?
I'm not sure. I think we have something, a couple of things lined up for early in the new year, but I'm not quite sure when and where yet. Doug, who's our wonderful drummer, is also our de facto manager, and sometimes he just tells us to hold a date in our diary. And then we find out later what it is and where it is because, you know, he doesn't like us to get overexcited. But we've done 12 gigs this year, including we went to Iceland 2 weekends ago. Unfortunately, I had to cry off because I had flu. I was really disappointed. I hear they were pretty good, but not as good as they normally are, obviously.
Obviously.
So we're all having this, we're having a collective midlife crisis.
God bless you. There's an affinity, I think, between crime fiction writers and music. Michael Connelly famously includes a lot of jazz.
Yes,
Chris Brookmeyer, always. I built a mix list based on one of his books because I thought the music was so amazing. Karen listens to music. In your interview with The Gentlewoman, which, by the way, I think is an amazing title for a publication, talked about Blondie. And, it's something I think a lot of readers or many readers don't understand, that it's a similar construct, building a song and building a story.
Yeah. And I have to tell you, tail end of last, actually met Debbie Harry. And that, for me, was one of the absolute high points, up there alongside the first time I met Ruth Rendell. You know, it's up there. I came over completely fangirl. I was, weak at the knees, and I said, I've been in love with you for 40 years. And she said, well, that deserves a kiss.
Oh, my gosh.
Debbie Harry kissed me.
And, of course, we should mention that she said you had fabulous hair, which you do. You have extraordinary hair. You are incredibly engaged with both your readership through social media and the crime fiction writing community. You are very, very open to new writers and encouraging to new writers. And that's another call on your time. Is that part of your incredible work ethic and you devote time to this? You're so kind to your readers when I follow you on Twitter, and you are so kind to them. Every reader that mentions that they've read your book, you acknowledge. I think that's, and considering your readership is in the millions, I think that's really amazing.
Thankfully, they're not all on Twitter. But no, I don't regard being interested in new writers as a work thing at all. I mean, I'm interested in new writers because I'm interested in where people who are coming fresh to the genre are going, what they're saying, what they're doing, what I can learn from them as well, in terms of what they're writing about, what's interesting to them, things I might have kind of missed about what's going on in society. And also, I mean, I'm keen to get on the bandwagon if somebody's got terrific talent. I do the new Blood panel at the Harrogate Crime Writing Festival, the Thiepston Crime Writing Festival. And for me, one of the great joys is I get to choose four people every year that are, I think, class acts. And that, for me, is an exciting thing. And it works both ways, because if I find four really good people and the audience all go away and read the books and love them and tell their friends, that kind of reflects nicely on me, too. So they go, that Pam McDermott, she's got a good eye. So it's not completely altruistic. But I also remember when I was starting out, and I was very nervous and very scared, and I knew that I was doing things a bit differently from what other people were doing. And there were some writers, a handful of writers, who were really key when I was starting out. Sarah Paretsky, Sue Grafton, Reginald Hill, Barbara Wilson. They all held out a helping hand to me. And, I know what that felt like in the early days and how reassuring that felt when I was starting out and felt extremely unconfident. So, it doesn't cost me anything. It doesn't cost anything to be nice to people, to give them a wee helping hand, to welcome them into the fold.
Well, you mentioned this, and this is our last question. You mentioned that Karen is still talking to you. And so I'm wondering where in the queue the next Karen book is, because I'm sure you've got a Tony Hill and Carol Jordan, I'm sure there's one of those in the queue. And will we hear from Karen again?
Yeah, I left them in a kind of difficult place. So, as I say, I left Tony and Carol in quite a difficult place. So I'll be working on moving them out of that difficult place and back into a point where I can actually write a book with them. But there will be more Karen down the line. certainly. And I also have an idea for a standalone that I'm quite keen to do some work on. So I'm not quite sure the order of play at the moment. But, yeah, that's what's on the slate.
And then, of course, there is the theatrical production, which might bring many legions of your fans from the States to the UK, you know, to see it on the West End or Edinburgh.
Yeah, well, of course, we might end up transferring it to Broadway. You never know.
Thank you again, Val, for your time, Professor McDermott, for your time and answering my questions and your patience. I do appreciate it.
You're welcome, Nancy. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.